Chapter 10. Up the Mississippi to Winter Camp, November 1803 to March 1804. The expedition headed out into the Mississippi, then turned upstream. Lewis and Clark scholar Arlen Large speculates that this may have been the instant when the captains decided they needed more men. The power of that river, with its boils and swirls and floating obstacles, awed them. Back east, Robert Fulton was doing his first experiments with a steamboat, but on the Mississippi, the expedition was proceeding at a pace closer to that of the first century than to the age of steamboats. Lewis now was face to face with what would be his major problem almost until he reached the Continental Divide, moving relatively large craft upstream on a major river. The pirogues were badly undermanned. The keelboat was woefully so. They had to cross the river, east to west, west to east, at every bend, because only in the relatively slack water downstream from a point of land could they make any significant progress north. In 8 hours of constant rowing or paddling, the expedition made 10.5 miles. Much more muscle power was needed. In addition, one man would have to stay constantly at the bow of the keelboat, watching for huge uprooted trees rushing downstream on the boiling current. More men would require more supplies. Lewis had a lot to think about while the men dug in for all they were worth as the tiny fleet slowly inched its way north. He and Clark were not men who made snap judgments, but in this case it is likely that Arlen Large got it right. They decided on the first day to expand the party by more than 100%. Over the next few days, the men worked the craft upstream, seldom making more than 1 mile per hour. Even more maddening, the river twisted and turned to such an extent that the 25 air miles to Cape Girardeau were 48 river miles. It took 4 days to reach the Cape. The village had been founded by Louis Lorimier some 20 years earlier. A French-Canadian, he had been a loyalist during the Revolution and had fought George Rogers Clark, who had burned down one of his establishments, worth $20,000. This broke him as a merchant, Lewis noted in his journal on November 25th, but Lorimier was a high-risk-taking, fast-talking, hard-bargaining, vigorous and ambitious frontier entrepreneur, a man who could recover from disaster. After General Clark burned him out, Lorimier talked the Spanish into giving him a land grant on the west bank of the river. He built a trading post at Cape Girardeau. He encouraged American immigration into the area, which consequently flourished. Lewis called on Lorimier and was told that the boss was at a horse race. Lewis went to the course. The scene reminded me very much of their small races in Kentucky among the uncivilized backwoodsmen. Nor did the subsequent disorder which took place in consequences of the decision of the judges of the race at all lessen the resemblance. It is not extraordinary that these people should be disorderly. They are almost entirely immigrant from the frontiers of Kentucky and Tennessee, and are the most dissolute and abandoned even among these people. They are men of desperate fortunes, but little to lose either character or property. Lorimier, on the other hand, intrigued him. Nearly 60 years old, he could not read or write. He had a remarkable suit of hair. It touched the ground when he stood erect. When sewed, it is kept close to his back by means of a leather girdle. Lorimier's wife was a Shawnee woman. He had many children by her, including a daughter who caught Lewis's eye. She is remarkably handsome and dresses in a plain yet fashionable style, or such as is now common in the Atlantic states, among the respectable people of the middle class. She is an agreeable, affable girl, and much the most decent-looking female I have seen since I left Louisville. On November 28th, the expedition reached the army post at Kaskaskia, on the Illinois side, some 60 miles below St. Louis. It was home to Captain Russell Bissell's infantry company and to Captain Amos Stoddard's artillery company. Lewis's first act was to show the captains his orders from Dearborn, authorizing him to raid their companies. Then he called for volunteers and made his selections. The exact number is not known. Arlen Large thinks it was something more than a dozen. Not all would go all the way to the Pacific. Lewis was thinking of sending a detachment back to St. Louis from the Mandan villages, where he anticipated spending the winter of 1804-5. Lewis also requisitioned Stoddard for 75 pounds of powder and a cask to hold it. On December 4th, Clark set out with the boat party, headed for the mouth of Wood River, upstream from St. Louis on the Illinois side, directly opposite the mouth of the Missouri. The word was that it was well timbered, with plenty of game and a nearby settlement of pioneers. Lewis traveled up the Illinois bank by horseback. He arrived at the village of Cahokia, almost directly across from St. Louis, on December 7th. The next morning, Lewis crossed the river to St. Louis, along with Nicholas Jarrett, a Cahokia fur trader, as interpreter to meet the Spanish Lieutenant Governor of Upper Louisiana, Colonel Carlos de Holt de Lassus. The meeting had some rough spots. De Lassus denied Lewis permission to go up the Missouri until the transfer of sovereignty had taken place in St. Louis. Lewis did not argue the point. It was too late in the season to press on anyway, and Lewis needed to be near St. Louis to purchase supplies for the extra men. Lewis told de Lassus that his objective was to explore the Missouri country, purely for scientific purposes. De Lassus, in a report to his superiors, said he had heard different. According to advices, I believe that his mission has no other object than to discover the Pacific Ocean, following the Missouri, and to make intelligent observations, because he has the reputation of being a very well-educated man and of many talents. Built on a bluff above the floodplain, St. Louis, when Lewis arrived, was 4 decades old, with a population of a little over 1,000, mainly French Canadians. For so young and so small a town, St. Louis had a critical role to play in a vast empire. It was the center of the fur trade for the huge region drained by the Missouri. Most of the trade goods came from across the ocean, then crossed the continent to reach St. Louis. From that central point, the goods fanned out via individual traders to the farthest reaches of the frontier. And the pirogues and keelboats that carried the trade goods to the Indians brought back stacks and stacks of beautiful furs that brought kings ransoms in Europe. Business opportunities abounded, in short, and continued to expand because of the American pioneers slipping across to the Spanish side and making farms on the pieces of ground they had cleared. When the formal transfer of Louisiana from Spain to France and then to the United States took place, expected sometime in the coming spring, Americans would be rushing into the Missouri country. They would need outfitting. As if things weren't good enough for the St. Louis merchants, here came Meriwether Lewis, with only enough supplies in hand for a party of 15, instead of the amounts needed for a party of 45, and armed with an authorization from the president to buy whatever he might need and charge it to the army. The merchants of the day had suddenly become the first military contractors in St. Louis. In addition to supplies, Lewis was going to need men, voyagers with strong backs who could paddle the pirogues up the Missouri to the Mandan villages. He would be spending a lot of time in the town, haggling with merchants, sizing up volunteers. Before Lewis left Washington, Jefferson had given him oral instructions to gather as much statistical information as possible on Upper Louisiana, which meant another job to do in St. Louis. At the time he arrived in St. Louis, Lewis had not yet received Jefferson's direct orders to abandon his risky plan to ride to Santa Fe during the winter months, but he had put the foolish thought out of his mind anyway. His problem was going to be finding enough time to do all that needed to be done, not how to pass time. First came winter camp. On December 9th, Lewis crossed to the Illinois side and met Clark and the party at Cahokia. He reported that the Spanish would not allow a movement up the Missouri, but Jarrett had a claim to a 400-acre tract at the mouth of Wood River and suggested Lewis would find it a good place to build huts for the winter, to get started on modifying the keelboat for the long haul up the Missouri, and to select and train the men for the permanent party. Clark went on to the site to look it over. Lewis returned to St. Louis to get going on his tasks. He began by doing his research on Upper Louisiana. It was the first survey done by an American of any part of the purchase. Lewis worked up a questionnaire with such queries as the population, the number of immigrants from the United States into Louisiana, how much land had been granted to individuals, the value of the imports and exports to and from St. Louis, and so on. Then he set out to talk to the men in town who had some knowledge of the local and regional situation. He turned first to Antoine Soulard, Surveyor General of Upper Louisiana for the Spanish government. Soulard, a Frenchman, told Lewis that the 1800 census recorded a population of about 10,000 in Upper Louisiana, 2,000 of whom were slaves. About two-thirds of the whites were Americans. That was 3 years ago. In 1803 alone, it was estimated that another 100 American families had crossed over into Upper Louisiana. Scouts from North Carolina and elsewhere had come to look over the Missouri country in search of some eligible positions to form settlements as soon as the American government is in operation. In reporting these and other matters to Jefferson, Lewis referred to an idea Jefferson had often expressed to him, that the American pioneers in Upper Louisiana could be persuaded to accept land in Illinois in exchange for their holdings. It was Jefferson's notion that the land west of the Mississippi could be turned into a vast Indian reservation, where the Indians could learn to farm and become good citizens. That way, there could be an orderly progression of the frontier, across Ohio and Indiana and on to Illinois, and a frontier free from Indian troubles, since all the Indians would be removed to the far shore. This absurd notion showed how little Jefferson knew about Americans living west of the Appalachians. With the purchase, or even without the purchase, there was no force on earth that could stop the flow of American pioneers westward. Good, cheap land was a magnet that reached all the way back to Europe. The pioneers were the cutting edge of an irresistible force. Rough and wild though they were the advance agents of millions of Europeans, mostly peasants or younger sons of small farmers, who constituted the greatest mass migration in history. When Lewis and Clark arrived on the Mississippi River, they were following the first American settlers in Missouri and were but a jump ahead of thousands of others who were thinking about or already on their way to Missouri. Napoleon had gotten it right. He might as well sell and get some money for the place because the Americans were going to overrun it anyway. Lewis must have known that the government couldn't get the pioneers to abandon the land they had cleared and cultivated, yet he wrote Jefferson, "I am fully persuaded that your wishes to withdraw the inhabitants of Louisiana may in every necessary degree be effected in the course of a few years." With a bit more realism, he added that the slaveholders might cause trouble. They would not want to cross into the free territory of Illinois. Lewis also did research for his tour. Soulard gave him a map that traced the Missouri to the mouth of the Osage River. Lewis got two other maps, one a general map of Upper Louisiana, and another the so-called McKay map, made by Scottish trader and explorer James McKay, which Lewis sent Jefferson. In 1795, McKay had gone as far up the Missouri as the village of the Omahas, and the following year he had sent a young assistant, John Evans, on a mission to the Pacific. Evans got no farther than the Mandan villages, but at least that gave McKay the information he needed to extend his map of the Missouri as far up as the Mandans. McKay was living in St. Louis in 1803, and Lewis had profitable talks with him. As historian Roy Appleman puts it, from McKay and the maps Lewis had available to him, Lewis knew virtually everything that was known to white men of the Missouri country as far as the Mandan villages and some Indian information about the lands to their west. The most powerful and prominent St. Louis citizens were the French fur traders Auguste Chouteau Sr., a founder of the city, his half-brother Pierre Chouteau Sr., and their brother-in-law Charles Gratiot, who had established the first trading post at Cahokia in 1777. Gratiot had helped supply George Rogers Clark during the Revolution. William Clark had stayed at Gratiot's house during a September 1797 business trip to St. Louis, where he also hobnobbed with Auguste Chouteau and all the fine girls and buckish gentlemen. The Chouteaus had prospered in St. Louis, thanks to a license that gave them exclusive rights on trade, but much of their wealth was in land, taken in payment for goods. Their need was the need of those on the frontier everywhere. Fluid capital, long-term credit, and cash. Money was so scarce in St. Louis that beaver skins were the coin of the land. The Chouteaus had a nice setup. A monopoly, in fact, of every imported item needed, and many of those desired on the frontier, from nails to glass beads, from ironwork to ladies' dresses, from powder and lead to imported wine. But it was too good to last. In 1798, Manuel Lisa arrived in St. Louis and began to muscle his way into the fur trade. He was as quick and sharp as the Chouteaus, having grown up in New Orleans, where he had hustled a living on the teeming waterfront. He moved upstream to St. Louis, where, as a Spaniard, he got preferential treatment, including some generous land grants. But he had no intention of becoming a farmer. He could see that the real opportunity in St. Louis was in trade. He began agitating for economic liberty. His biographer, Richard Oglesby, says his attack on monopolies made him sound as if he was one of Adam Smith's most ardent disciples. To shut him up, the Spanish gave him a license to trade. From these merchants, Lewis began making his purchases. Corn, flour, biscuits, barrels of salt, kegs of pork, boxes of candles, kegs of hog's lard, 600 pounds grease, 21 bales of Indian goods, tools of every description. He bought from the Chouteaus, he bought from Lisa. He asked questions and got more information for Jefferson. He studied his maps. On December 16th, Driard reported in. He had brought the 8 soldiers from Tennessee with him. Delighted, Lewis quickly examined them. Disappointed, he wrote Clark he found them not possessed of more of the requisite qualifications. There is not a hunter among them. Still, there were possibilities. One of the soldiers was a blacksmith, and another was a house joiner. Lewis sent them on to Clark at Wood River. Eventually, 4 of the 8 passed muster. Through the winter, Lewis kept up an active correspondence with Jefferson. Many letters recorded by Jefferson as received from Lewis, and many letters Jefferson wrote and noted, are missing. Still, what is available is informative and suggestive. On January 13, 1804, Jefferson wrote Lewis, saying he had been able to follow Lewis's progress by newspaper accounts. He reported that the transfer of Louisiana to the United States had been scheduled for December 20th, and he had no doubt it had occurred. The acquisition of the country through which you are to pass has inspired the public generally with a great deal of interest in your enterprise, Jefferson wrote. The inquiries are perpetual as to your progress. The feds alone still treat it as philosophism and would rejoice in its failure. Their bitterness increases with the diminution of their numbers and despair of a resurrection. I hope you will take care of yourself and be the living witness of their malice and folly. To put it another way, those misguided Federalists who had criticized the purchase and derided the expedition were committing political suicide, so the President's aide need not worry about pleasing them by making a ride to Santa Fe. Avoiding unnecessary risks was the way Lewis could confound the feds. On January 22nd, Jefferson wrote Lewis to confirm that the transfer had happened in New Orleans on December 20th and to give him instructions on how to deal with the Indians now that the United States was sovereign throughout Louisiana. The instructions came down to tell them they have a new father. Jefferson also wanted Lewis to offer the Osage chief a free trip to Washington to meet the new father and to be impressed by the power and numbers of the Americans. Jefferson closed with the welcome news that the American Philosophical Society had elected Lewis to membership. He had earned it. 2 years of study under Thomas Jefferson, followed by his crash course in Philadelphia, had made Lewis into exactly what Jefferson had hoped for in an explorer. A botanist with a good sense of what was known and what was unknown, a working vocabulary for description of flora and fauna, a map maker who could use celestial instruments properly, a scientist with keen powers of observation, all combined in a woodsman and an officer who could lead a party to the Pacific. Now the payoff for the American Philosophical Society savants began. In March, and again in May, Lewis sent boxes of specimens to Jefferson. They constituted the first shipment of natural history specimens by Lewis to Jefferson from west of the Mississippi, and thus the first ever. He included slips or cuttings from trees owned by Pierre Chouteau, who had gotten them from the Osage Indian village 300 miles to the west. Lewis wrote 3 long paragraphs of detailed description. As a man of the Enlightenment, now officially signified by his membership in the APS, Lewis was interested in practical uses of the tree, which he named the Osage apple, now the Osage orange. The fruit was never eaten, but the wood was perfect for making bows. So much do the savages esteem the wood of this tree for the purpose of making their bows that they travel many 100 miles in quest of it. That was Lewis's first description of a plant unknown to science. He could anticipate making many more. There are trees growing in Philadelphia at 4th and Spruce Streets, and the University of Virginia at Moriah, a guest house, today that grew from the cuttings Lewis sent. And as historian Michael Broadhead notes, this was the beginning of a rich, almost uniquely American phenomenon, the military naturalist. Among Lewis's worries that winter was Clark's commission. Clark had been on active service since the previous summer, but by February 1804, his commission had still not arrived. On February 10th, Lewis wrote Dearborn and Jefferson about the matter. Through to the end of April, he got no reply, nor did the commission arrive in the meantime. The matter continued to nag. The missing commission had no practical effect. Lewis called Clark captain, and their relationship was one of a genuine joint command. Indeed, through the second part of December and all of January, Clark was the officer with the troops in the field. He planned and oversaw the construction of the huts. He made a number of improvements to the keelboat, including some cleverly devised lockers running along the sides of the boat with lids that could be raised to form a breastwork or shield. When the lids were down, they provided catwalks or passe-avants for men with poles pushing the boat. Crosswise between the lockers, Clark had 11 benches built, each 3 feet long for use by two oarsmen. He added center poles to support an awning. Clark worried about the Indians. The word among the Americans living near the mouth of the Missouri was that upriver the Sioux were hostile, numerous, well-armed, and certain to demand a ransom for passage. Clark added a bronze cannon, probably